Hi there, Alphonse here, and coming up next, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. James Fetzer. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He's co-founder of the Scholars for 911 Truth. Dr. Steve Jones is the other founder, and it'll be an interesting interview. We're kind of go all over the board and talk about the grand scheme of things, as well as specifics with regard to the 911 attacks. But I think it was a pretty good interview, and I thank the benevolent benefactors, the people who donated money and made this possible. And we're, Jim and I and the other Scholars for 911 Truth, of which I'm a member as well, our goal, of course, is to get the word out about the dire circumstances that we find ourselves in as a benevolent idiot is overthrowing our country in not-so-clever, not-so-well-disguised coup d'etat fashion. And I don't know how we're going to solve the problem, but I think the first step in solving the problem is to make people aware that there is a problem, and it's a big one. Just about the biggest problem that any body politic anywhere in the world has ever faced. And the fate of the United States and the world hangs in the balance.
We are honored to be speaking with Dr. James Fetzer, professor of philosophy at the University of Minnesota Duluth, co-founder of Scholars for 911 Truth. We will be discussing some of the lies, physical anomalies, and the likely political consequences surrounding the 911 attacks, and ways that we the people can affect a favorable outcome. While the rule of law and the Constitution are clearly under attack by the same people who engineered 911. Welcome to the Grassroots Infomedias of the People Radio Show, James.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm pleased to be on with you.
Yeah, you've been speaking out about 911. You have a website called Scholars for 911 Truth. The URL is st911.org.
That's right.
Gets about 6,000 hits a day as far as I can tell. Very successful, very quick. What made you come forward at this point in time and talk about these problems with the 911 government line?
Well, it was a confluence of factors, I think. I'd spent a lot of time, some 15 years, studying the death of JFK by bringing together the best qualified people to ever investigate and to try to take rumor, speculation, and politics out of the case and place its study on an objective and scientific foundation. We were very successful. The problem there was separating the authentic from the inauthentic evidence because we discovered the autopsy x-rays had been altered to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head. Another had been altered by adding a 6.5 metallic slice. That someone else's brain had been substituted with the brain of JFK. Basically, if you're going to patch up the back of the skull where most of his brains were blown out, then you're going to have to reconstitute the brain. We discovered that the whole movie, the Zapruder film of the assassination, had been recreated using sophisticated techniques of optical printing and special effects, and that Lee Oswald had been framed using manufactured evidence. So I'd done a huge amount of research on JFK, published three books, over 500 pages, bringing together studies by experts on different aspects of the case, hundreds of talk shows, television appearances, the whole bit, chairing or co-chairing four national conferences. When I discovered 9/11, I think probably the light dawned when I read David Ray Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor, because it was such a clear distillation of evidence, and the case was so clear and so straightforward, and the physics was so simple that it was very difficult for me to imagine that a lot of people hadn't pieced together what actually happened here. And yet there was so little discussion in the national media, practically none, and the government was simply ignoring the whole matter. Bush, of course, and Cheney had fought having an investigation of 9/11. When they finally buckled under because of the political pressure brought about by the families of the survivors, you know, the survivor families of the victims of 9/11. When the political pressure became too acute, then they created a commission that was basically advisory to the president, rather like the Warren Commission was advisory to President Johnson. I have no idea about the legal status of these commissions, but I think it's probably next to nothing, so that the American people are given the impression that there's been a thorough investigation and it has some legal standing, when actually it does not. In this case, I think they affected the gutting of a serious investigation by making sure that an inside insider from the Bush administration would be the executive director, a fellow named Philip Zelikow, who not only had supervised transition in relation to the national security apparatus from the Clinton to the Bush administration, but who had even co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice, such that now we have a 9/11 commission report from which, for example, the whole section on Saudi Arabia has been withheld and withdrawn on grounds of national security, which is rather shocking considering that 15 of the 19 alleged hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, so that there's no investigation of a possible Saudi role. Of course, all the blame was placed on Saddam Hussein, when in fact the number of hijackers that were from Iraq was zero, count them, zero. In addition, of course, it ignores the fall of the collapse of World Trade Center Building Number 7, a 47-story structure that came down at 5:20 in the afternoon, which was an obvious controlled demolition. We know, even know that Larry Silverstein, who had leased the World Trade Center and had insured it for some $3.5 billion against a terrorist attack as late as 6 weeks before this all took place, had suggested that the building should be pulled, which is construction language for having it brought down by controlled demolition. He said that they made the decision, that the fire people made the decision to pull it, and that we watched it come down. It's a perfect illustration of a controlled demolition. There's a slight implosion toward the center, comes down at the speed of free fall, perfectly symmetrical into its own footprint. Must have been very powerful explosives that were used to do it, because there were pools of molten metal there for 3, 4, and 5 weeks after, just as there were pools of similar pools of molten metal in the sub-basements of the World Trade Center 1 and 2. The methods used to bring down the other buildings was rather different, apparently, however, because they exploded from the top down. I mean, when you watch 7 go down, there's no explosion at the top. You get all the dust and debris rising up from the bottom, which is what you would expect. Suppose you took a grand piano, for example, and released it off of the top of one of the towers. Well, then it would come down in about 10 seconds, and it would fly into pieces and a lot of dust and debris blow up from the bottom. But in this case, these buildings are blowing up from the top down. So the fact of the matter is, when I turned attention to 9/11, it seemed to me the case for controlled demolition in the World Trade Center was so blatant, so obvious, that it had to be the case that a lot of people knew what really was going on and it was being covered up by the government. Well, I was used to that from JFK, so it was motivating to me, especially seeing somebody as heroic as David Ray Griffin making these trips around the country and giving lectures, one of which was even picked up by C-SPAN, about how the evidence all indicated that things weren't as they should be. It seemed to me he could use a little help. And in mid-December, I found myself in the midst of a group of about two dozen rather talented individuals who all had different degrees of expertise who are concerned about 9/11, and I floated the idea, this was an email group, to form a loose affiliation, a kind of society that could organize conferences, you know, sponsor lectures, publications, that sort of thing. To my surprise, a couple of members of this group were hesitant, thinking it would somehow constrain them from speaking out on their own. Of course, nothing like that was the case. But I realized I didn't need their permission to found the society. I invited Steve Jones, this physicist from BYU, who had done all the work on the controlled demolition, to be my co-chair. And on the 15th of December, I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth.
Mm-hmm. How did you come in contact with Dr. Steve Jones?
Well, David Ray Griffin had contacted me some time earlier. He had studied the books that I had published on JFK. He liked my work on JFK, and he was suggesting that we might do something in collaboration on JFK and 9/11. Well, he was a part of a very small group, including Steve Jones himself and a couple of others, discussing these matters, and I became included in that group. And that was how I had my first contact with Steve Jones. When I invited him to join me as co-chair, I did not know if he would say yay or nay, and I was only hopeful that he would say yes, and of course he did, and we've proceeded from there.
Do you think a lot of the academics are reluctant to speak out? Saw what they did to Ward Churchill. He hasn't been saying much since his media frenzy.
That's an interesting observation. I thought Ward Churchill was very courageous. Actually, most academicians tend to be wimps. They tend to, the last thing they want is to be embarrassed. They are mostly unwilling to take strong stands on, especially on political issues. It's ironic because you'd think tenure would be an institution that would encourage speaking out on controversial issues, and yet it's a very tiny percentage of faculty who are ever willing to take the risks involved in speaking out, even though presumably with tenure there wouldn't be a risk to your job. But we do know, even in the case of Steve Jones, for example, BYU has not wanted him to be involved in any of activities other than scholarly, purely scholarly academic presentations, and he's been basically doing that so that I'm the principal spokesperson for the organization.
Yeah. So do you think the academics are not speaking out because of pressure? Because I think that the evidence is, I think they know. I think the academics have to know, physicists, engineers. They've got to know that this story is just full of holes and fishy. They've got to know, don't they?
Well, I think the interesting case is the structural engineers. I mean, you know, structural engineering has to obey the laws of physics, and these temperature differentials and so forth aren't anything that they can change or violate. And we have physicists, we have mechanical engineers, we have pilots, we have aeronautical engineers. We have many different scientific specializations represented in our group of scholars and experts. And yet, I would say structural engineers are underrepresented. In fact, those who would try to convey the impression to the public that we don't know what we're talking about would say, how many structural engineers are there? Actually, a couple just joined the society the other day because I process applications for membership, and I expect more will, but there have also been stories that were really indefensible that have appeared in some of the professional journals that suggest that the buildings actually fell because the temperatures were too high, or that the buildings pancaked. I mean, the pancaking theory is quite a ridiculous hypothesis. Some of them ignore the fact that there were those 47 steel columns up the middle of the buildings that made them so distinctive, so that they treat the collapse of one floor on another as though it wouldn't be resisted by those structures. The fact of the matter is, of course, the longer the fire burns, since it's converting mass into energy, the less weight there is to be supported by those higher at those higher elevations. And the buildings were built so massively, you know, I mean, they really were overbuilt in the sense that they could support much more weight than they were required to support. So some of them claim, you know, you have one floor pancaking on another. I mean, that's the implicit official position. But you have to consider it takes time for one floor to, you know, collapse on another. Not only were the plane impacts not sufficient and the fires too meager, so the steel didn't weaken, much less melt, but it would take a lot of time for one floor to pancake on another. I just take a key ring and release it from my hand when I'm standing up, you know, and it starts to fall and I count 1,000, you know, and by the time I say 1,000, it can't even get to 1,001, it's hit the ground. That's about a half a second. If you assume that one floor of these buildings collapsing on another took a half second on the average, maybe slower to begin with and faster later, that would have taken 55 seconds for these buildings, 110-story buildings to collapse. Well, they fell in 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
The very same speed as free fall. So they're 45 seconds too fast to have fallen in anything like. I mean, there's no way in which you can give a reasonable estimate of the amount of time it would take for one floor to impact on another, and here you're fighting, you know, the resistance of the floors and the laws of inertia and so forth in order to have this overcome the support of the lower buildings. When you look at some of the footage, there's a documentary entitled 9/11 Revisited that shows some really excellent footage of the collapse. And you can actually see the floors being blown out by massive explosions. I mean, you can see some of the explosions. You can see the explosions going off before they're enveloped by this huge cloud of dust, which is the second smoking gun in this case. I mean, if the first is the black billowing smoke because it shows that the temperature, it was an oxygen-starved fire, and the temperatures were burning much lower than their optimum, which was already 1,000 degrees beyond, you know, the melting point of steel. It's the huge enveloping smoke cloud around the building that is the true smoking gun, because there had to be a separate source of energy. It couldn't have been caused by the fires or the planes or the floors collapsing. It's what it's actually doing is pulverizing the concrete that was a flooring material used in the building and turning it into extremely fine dust. And in addition, if you look carefully, you see steel beams are being blasted outward and even upward. Well, that required some separate, independent, and very massive source of energy. Mm-hmm. Steve Jones has actually estimated that the use of thermate probably was responsible, where thermate is a very powerful sulfur-enhanced version of something called thermite, and which may have in turn been used in a form that was enhanced by nanotechnology that makes it hundreds of times more powerful, so it attained temperatures of in excess of 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit and just cut through steel, like, you know, just essentially vaporize it. I mean, one of the striking features of the scene of collapse afterward that any number of observers noted was that there was nothing there. There was nothing discernible, no desks, there were no chairs, no computers, there was nothing discernible. It all had been completely blasted apart. Well, that's exactly the kind of effect you'd get from the use of a nano-enhanced version of thermate, for example.
Yeah, well, if every action, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, you should be able to calculate the energy sink, and it should equal exactly the energy that's available. And I'm to understand that that's not even close to the case.
That's absolutely right, including these pools, these vast pools of molten metal that were there 3, 4, and 5 weeks later. I mean, that's stunning. Those are in excess of, maybe the 3,000 degrees. I mean, it's just stunning that this stuff would be there.
Yeah, where'd that energy come from?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
You should be able to account for it all, and you can't.
That's exactly right.
It's just amazing.
So, I mean, it's a simple, from the point of view of physics, if you have some basic rudimentary understanding here, and yet most Americans, I'm sorry to say, don't possess that simple scientific sophistication, and therefore are left at the mercy of what their government tells them, especially when you have a media that's right. So compliant with the government that basically is repeating the stories. It's as though the government were planning every story. And, you know, when we discover that the government is planning stories and paying reporters in Iraq to publish stories, and also has paid off reporters here in the United States to print stories favorable to administration policies, you begin to wonder how ubiquitous this practice has become. It's as though it's almost completely encompassing. My greatest distress has been with the print media, and in particular the New York Times. I mean, these events took place just down the street from the New York Times in Lower Manhattan. This is stunning that the New York Times has abdicated its responsibility to investigate these matters. There are sophisticated, educated, knowledgeable people at the New York Times who have to know that this was a controlled demolition, and it cost the lives of 3,000 New Yorkers. You'd think that the nation's foremost newspaper would assume a leadership role here, which it has completely abandoned.
Well, I believe that the media is under the control of somebody other than them, the editors, or I don't know who they're talking to or who they're answering to, but it's not to the truth.
Well, that's a bloody shame. Of course, you know, there's a way of describing the form of government we have today. Mussolini called it corporatism. It's a blend, a merger of big government and big business, where militarism and nationalism are principal features. So this, you know, our aggressive military posture abroad is the sort of thing to be expected from this kind of government. It's one in which the leader is identified with the state, so any criticism of the leader is interpreted as criticism of the state and viewed as either unpatriotic or even treasonous. I think that's the attitude that has been fostered here. Mussolini observed this form of government could also be described as fascism, and that's basically, I think, what we have today. We have a government that has turned over the resources of the United States to be exploited and appropriated by major corporations, especially the gas and oil companies, for the sake of increasing their profit margins.
I wouldn't forget the bankers.
And the bankers and the financiers aren't doing too badly either, but I think they're very worried, you see, about the conversion from petrodollars to petro-euros, which Iraq, Iran, and even Venezuela have been contemplating, if not actively pursuing. So that there are a lot of us who are suspicious that the very wealthy, the most wealthy influences in the country are very concerned that this conversion not take place. Of course, in the past, we had a gold standard. You can convert paper money for gold, or a silver standard where you can convert paper money for silver, but today the dollar, largely the value of it depends upon its connection to oil. So if that connection is severed by switching to euros as the basic monetary unit for the purchase, buying, and selling of oil, then the American dollar stands in a position where it's vulnerable to free fall. Of course, we have $9 trillion in deficit, the greatest deficit in American history, and an awful lot of that debt is held by foreign nations, including Japan and China. And if they decided they wanted to collect on those debts, why, we would be in financial catastrophe. The dollar would be in free fall.
Yeah, but the whole rest of the world would be too, wouldn't they?
Well, it depends. The dollar has been an international unit of currency, but the euro has been gaining ground, and I frankly think that it's probably a good thing for the world if the United States turns out to be so financially destitute that it can't finance the wars that it would be conducting abroad. I mean, we put ourselves in an impossible position. This guy, you know, claims to be the security president, but national security is rooted in economic security, and he's run us into bankruptcy. I mean, $9 trillion of debt. It's also rooted, obviously, in military security, and yet our military forces are being depleted. They're being butchered abroad. We have had generals for years who are saying the Army's at the breaking point, and the National Guard is being depleted. So here, on the one hand, he's decimating our economic security. On the other hand, he's decimating our military security. And God knows the most important measure of our standing in the world has been completely annihilated, which is our moral posture. I mean, the reason why the United States has been a safe and secure nation for so very long is because most of the world has looked at us with admiration and awe, not shock and awe, but awe, because we have been so generous, altruistic, self-sacrificing on behalf of other nations. Witness, for example, the Marshall Plan, or, you know, going to war to help Europe defeat the Nazis and all that kind of thing. We have been famous for that, but we've squandered it all since Bush came into office. I mean, since the very day he came into office, he's been gutting all the things that have made the United States such an admired nation. And I'm afraid now that we're simply looked upon as the biggest bully on the block. No nation, you know, it respects us. Many nations may fear us, but nations don't respect and admire us. And that is, I think, our most precious heritage, which has been utterly squandered in this brief 5 years.
Yes, I hope we recover from it. What, do you think Iranian oil borscht is the reason for the recent sable rattling toward Iran?
Well, I think it's a very powerful motive. I mean, you know, you have a new Iranian president who indulges in a lot of inflammatory rhetoric, if in fact the translations are accurate. And how can we know? We're so dependent upon, you know, what the government tells us. They present videotape of Osama bin Laden, and it's pretty obvious it isn't Osama bin Laden, but they present it as though it were, and they give translation of what he said, and who knows, we're not in a position to second-guess the translation. My understanding is Osama denied he had anything to do with 9/11, but of course the government presents us with videotape that it claims he does, you know. This Moussaoui trial is one of the most bizarre experiences we've undergone of late, where this guy's completely flipped. I mean, you've been watching that?
Yeah.
Strange. Very strange. I mean, he's contradicting himself on all the material issues in the case, which means he's a completely impeached witness. He's impeached himself as a witness, which means you're entitled to disregard every single thing the man has ever said.
That could be the strategy, too.
Well, it could be, except, you know, maybe that might be right. I've heard a report, by the way, that he was actually wearing a stun belt when he was testifying. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I've got
it. Isn't that incredible? I mean, the idea that they might give it a nasty shock of a jolt of electricity if he didn't say the right thing. That's unbelievable. But if a judge were aware of that, I mean, that's intolerable as a judicial proceeding. It makes a farce of everything.
It's just crazy.
Well, we believe it's a classic show trial, you know, in the old Soviet sense anyway. Yeah. It's being used for psychological purposes to manipulate the American people.
There's so many bizarre things going on, you can't keep track of them all.
It's true. I'm sorry to say.
So, you know, a lot of folks would say that 911 was not an inside job. It would just take too many people to do it. What do you think about that? Would it take too many people inside our government, or could they possibly hire people outside the government?
Well, I think it was very cleverly done. For example, you're probably aware there were these five training ops going on that morning that were controlled by Dick Cheney from this underground bunker. I think that, you know, an awful lot of it was set up as a training op, and then you conduct the real operations under the guise of training operations, and it may have required a very small group of people to do it. There have been many famous cases in American history where very important projects were going on that involved significant numbers of people, and the beans didn't get spilled. One is the Manhattan Project creating the atom bomb. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were involved in that, and the word didn't leak out. There were all these experiments involving the studies of the course of syphilis with prisoners, and some of the best hospitals and physicians in the country were involved in that, and the word didn't leak out. I mean, it would come out, you know, 40, 50 years later, we discover it. And the government just spends an awful lot of time. These operations are highly compartmentalized. It's all on a need-to-know basis. And when you have intimidation like this, you know, as far as military, I'm sure, for example, a large number of the so-called witnesses who claim that they saw a large aircraft impact the building, that not only would not know the difference between a 757 or a 767 or a 737 or something that was designed to look a lot like it, mm-hmm. but also, you know, were enlistees. I mean, they were just military people who were given prepared statements and told to sign them. I, as a former Marine Corps officer, I can assure you that my drill instructors could produce hundreds of recruits who would swear on their mother's grave that they had witnessed Bruce Wayne drive the Batmobile into the Pentagon. I'm just saying, you know, this can be done effortlessly. And, you know, we all know it's all very peculiar, of course, what happened at the Pentagon, because that west wing that the plane hit was the unoccupied, the least occupied, because it was just under reconstruction, so it had the fewest personnel, the fewest records. All the serious stuff was in the opposite side of the building. If they'd crashed the plane into any other part simply by crashing it through the ceiling, you know, they would have done much more damage and destruction than impacting where they ostensibly did. The lack of debris from the fuselage, the lack of wings, the lack of bodies, no seats, no luggage, no tail, no wings, no engines. I mean, it's all preposterous. No 757 hit the Pentagon. What may have hit the Pentagon appears to be a rather small plane, a jet fighter, maybe an A-3 Sky Warrior or an F-16. And, you know, I had a fellow come through Duluth here a couple of weeks ago who showed me a bunch of footage from a National Geographic special that included about 44 frames that had been taken of the fires at the Pentagon. And what was so striking about these 44 frames is if you took a good look, you could see the fire was in front of the building. It wasn't coming from inside the building. It was in front of the building, which corresponded to my impression from three photographs I have on a website, a public issues website I have separately, which is assassinationscience.com. If you go to assassinationscience.com and scroll down the menu bar to 9/11 links, you'll find one entitled 20 Studies Plus. And if you click on that, you'll not only see the initial hit point at the Pentagon, which is only about 10 feet high and 16 feet wide, with unbroken windows, fence, cars, all undamaged, and no airplane parts, no fuselage wings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you'll also see these photographs from in front of the Pentagon, and the billowing smoke is coming out of dumpsters. Well, that was very clear in the additional frames from the National Geographic. So this whole stuff was stunts. It was special effects. The whole thing was phony.
Yeah, I'm looking at some pictures of the Pentagon being hit here. I see the first explosions are white. And I thought, that looks like high-energy explosives, because hydrocarbons usually burn orange.
It depends what you're looking at. You're looking at a big kind of orange or white impact, almost perfectly circular in the center there. And are you looking at the side, and you see smoke already on the sides and so forth? Because you may be looking at what I take to be a photograph of a secondary impact that may have been what brought down the upper floors.
I think two things may have hit the Pentagon. Could have been two things, a cruise missile and the, because they were, there's evidence that they were equipping A-3 Sky Warriors with remote control devices.
Yeah.
And they could have put armament on them and fired the armament and then followed the armament right in with the aircraft.
No, that's my impression, too. In fact, from the one frame where you have a bit of a silhouette, a bit of an outline of what looks like a plane, it does fit a silhouette of a small fighter, and it could be an A-3, and you do see a plume that looks like it might be from a missile. So I'm inclined to agree with you exactly. Namely, it looks like a missile was fired into the building just before the small fighter craft hit it. Interestingly, I have a friend from JFK Research who has a buddy who is a truck driver who was right in front of the Pentagon when all this happened, and who wrote him and told him how a commercial airliner had come in right over his head as he was driving past the Pentagon and then swerved off to the left. Now, if you swerve off to the left, you're going to National Airport. And I think this may be the source of a tremendous amount of confusion. You had this big commercial airline come in and then swerve off to the left. Meanwhile, this small plane actually impacted the building. And they could occur in proximity that people who saw the big plane and didn't realize what was going on might think that it was what actually hit the building, and hence you got a lot of confusion.
Yeah, because there's a lot of witnesses, and they don't say the same thing, and it could be that sort of mistake where they saw that plane, and they saw the, you know, they saw the explosion, and they put two and two together in a post hoc sort of manner.
Yeah, well, the witnesses are all a mixed bag. I mean, one so-called witness was knocked flat on his face from the explosion behind him, so obviously he didn't see what hit it, and yet he's listed as a witness who saw what hit the building. So, and of course, all these military types who would have signed anything, you know, I think it's very suspicious. And obviously the physical evidence takes precedence over the eyewitness. I mean, if the physical evidence is inconsistent with an eyewitness account, you know the eyewitness account is wrong, unless, of course, the evidence has been faked. I mean, that's what happened in JFK. We had 40... There were at least 40 eyewitnesses, including people in Dealey Plaza at Parkland Hospital, where he was first taken at Bethesda, who said he had this massive blowout to the back of the head. Mm-hmm. And yet, when the House Select Committee reinvestigated the case, all that testimony, 40 eyewitnesses, was dismissed on the grounds that the autopsy x-rays didn't show it. But as I may have mentioned to begin with, the autopsy x-rays had been altered to conceal that massive blowout to the back of the head. So it took a special kind of skill, a guy who had both a Ph.D. in physics and an M.D. and who was board certified in radiation oncology, which, of course, is a treatment of cancer using x-ray therapy, so that he makes life and death decisions for his patients based on his interpretations of x-rays every day, to go into the National Archives and study the original x-rays and subject them to a kind of test called optical densitometry that he knew from physics that enabled him to calculate the relative density of the objects whose exposure to radiation created the images, and he discovers that the objects whose exposure to radiation created the images right at the back of the head were much too dense to be actual human bone. In other words, they had faked it by patching, as it were, actually through a use of double exposure, this hit big blowout, but using material that was too dense so that he was able to detect it.
Mm-hmm. You know what, the Pentagon, just after the planes hit, there were a lot of reports of military professionals smelling cordite, which is a byproduct of high-energy explosives. What do you make of that? Did you hear about
that?
Well,
I think those reports are probably right. You know, when you hear military reports that contradict the government's account, you're entitled to believe them. And when you hear military reports that support the government's account, when the government's account is so fishy, you tend to discount them. So I think those reports of cordite are probably accurate, which means there may well have been explosives there that were set off because the damage done by the plane wasn't significant enough, and that they wanted a more substantial appearance of damage to the building to convince the public psychologically that a big aircraft had hit it. And once those upper floors come down, you know, people say, wow, that's pretty big damage, and they don't look at the smooth and unblemished lawn. I mean, I have had pilots and aeronautical engineers explain how a big jumbo jet flying at high speed creates tremendous turbulence, and also a cushion of air, has to have a cushion of air beneath it, could not have been flown at those speeds at those low levels. In fact, the engines hang down, and either the fuselage or the engines would have been digging furrows in the lawn, and yet if it had happened anything like the way the government claims, alternatively, if the plane had come down at a substantial angle, there would have been an enormous crater there. Either way, there should have been a huge amount of debris of all different types, and none of it is present, so that, in essence, the smooth green lawn at the Pentagon, which is basically looks like a putting surface, is the smoking gun at the Pentagon.
You know, I often wondered why the pilot wouldn't just dive bomb right into the roof.
Yeah, that would have been a more effective and more damaging result. I mean, actually, you would have done a whole lot more damage doing it that way. In fact, the whole way the thing was executed suggests an effort to minimize damage to the Pentagon. See, I think Donald Rumsfeld is very proud of his office and proud of his building, and he didn't really want to do any more damage than was absolutely necessary. Well, I've heard a report, by the way, that I haven't yet been able to verify that what was actually hit was the one offices that were there were the Office of Naval Intelligence, and that they were conducting investigations into malfeasance in the Department of Defense. I don't know if you remember this, but the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld testified to Congress that the Pentagon had $2.3 trillion it couldn't account for.
Dov Zakheim was the comptroller. Yes, Mr. White, who was Secretary of the Army, who was in charge of their books, he couldn't balance his books either, and he tried to blame it on the Pentagon attack, even though his office is nowhere near where the attack took place.
Well, it's all quite stunning, really, truly. I
mean, that Mr. White came from Arthur Anderson, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Donald Rumsfeld's a very clever guy, and, I mean, the perfect day to announce that you had this massive loss of funds. I mean, it's got to be spectacular. This has got to be the greatest swindle theft in world history. $2.3 trillion is the day before there's going to be this traumatic event that's going to preoccupy anyone, so people aren't not only going to come back to ask where the money is, but they're going to start shoveling hundreds of billions of dollars your way so that you can strengthen the nation's defense and go after the evildoers. I mean, the evildoers were actually much more near at hand. They were right over at 1600 Pennsylvania in the West Wing and in the Pentagon itself.
I believe that to be true. Do you know about that Dov Zakheim story? He was the
An Israeli agent who was also the comptroller for the Pentagon, and that he may have played many, many roles here for diverse reasons.
Yeah, that's speculation. But I mean, there's enough information available to at least go, that doesn't look right.
And we certainly have ample evidence that Israel had foreknowledge of the event. For example, there was this group of five Israelis on a rooftop across the Hudson River who were celebrating, taking pictures and drinking, and, you know, residents of the area were very upset and called the police, who arrested them. Mm-hmm. They claimed they were art students, and they were eventually let go, but it's surely indicative that there was advanced knowledge. I mean, the Mossad is the best intelligence service in the world, and I think there's not much doubt that they knew what was going on. Of course, I believe they also warned the United States. I mean, talk about foreknowledge. David Shippers, who was the Democrat from Chicago who led the impeachment of Bill Clinton, tried for 3 weeks before 9/11 to contact John Ashcroft, our attorney general, to tell him that he had reports that there were going to be attacks using aircraft on the World Trade Center. And, of course, you may know from the Zacharias Moussaoui trial, this FBI agent who said he warned his supporters, his superiors, 70 times, count it, 70 times, that these guys were taking flight training, and he was suspected they might be interested in using aircraft as weapons, and he even said that they could target the World Trade Center, though he later called that a lucky guess. But you can't dismiss on the grounds of incompetence ignoring 70 warnings. That has to be not incompetence, but a deliberate policy, which I think, of course, was in place because the government was going to use the claim that these terrorists had perpetrated these acts as a subterfuge for their own malfeasance.
Well, Ashcroft was flying strictly non-commercial, according to some mainstream news media, starting in early 2001.
I think that's right, yeah. And, you know, Willie Brown allegedly was warned to not fly, and so were some others. So, and not to mention the put options, you know, all these wagers on the stock market that the stock of United and American Airlines and Dean Witter, which had huge offices in the World Trade Center, were going to decline, so that there still remain millions of dollars uncollected because they benefited from these stock options. Now, the fact is that the Securities and Exchange Commission, of course, keeps detailed records on all of these transactions, and if there was serious interest in knowing who had made or placed these transactions, it would be easy to ascertain. But, of course, the government has shown no interest whatsoever, no more interest than George Bush and Dick Cheney showed in even having a 9/11 commission investigation.
Well, to understand, some of the money trail led back to a gentleman named Buzzy Krongard, who was a former executive director of the CIA.
Yeah.
See, those records are there. I know that they know. Whoever placed those put options and sold them short knew what planes were going to be used because they left Delta alone and where they were going.
Yeah.
It's
amazing,
you know,
isn't it? I mean, it's so blatant. It's so in your face. It's like using an outfit to clean up all the steel and ship it off to Japan to be melted down and recycled when the fire chiefs and their newsletters are observing how this is illegal to remove it, that it has to be subjected to forensic analysis, and the outfit that's doing it is Controlled Demolition Incorporated. Same outfit that was used to clean up the Mura building in Oklahoma City, Controlled Demolition Incorporated.
I mean, you can go on and on and on with the exposition of this obvious, blatant, condemning evidence. It's just not funny. And what baffles me is that I guess the American people depend on authority. If the suit on TV says it, then it's so. And if they don't say it's so, then there's nothing you can do about it. Because
I'm afraid you're very close to the truth, that if it's not on TV, it's treated as though it isn't real, you know, and most Americans, alas, are so preoccupied with their own lives and their own problems and, you know, making enough money to keep food on the table or having their six-pack and watching their football game or whatever, that the amount of time they spend on the news is maybe 15 minutes a day. They just catch those headlines, and that's it. I don't think most Americans spend any time really even seriously reading a newspaper.
No, I'm pretty sure they don't. They don't seem to know the news, that's for sure. But, you know, that's the problem. We've been discussing the problems all along. So that's where we are now, where we want to be, and how are we going to get there. That's, you know, let's spend some time into the solution rather than defining the problems.
Well, the problem is the administration, which is completely corrupt, in the Congress, which needs to be reconstituted. So theoretically, the next election in November should be an opportunity to vote out of office every Democrat and every Republican who, you know, just replace them wholesale is my simplest solution, because too many of these people have just acquiesced. The Democrats seem to me to be spineless wimps, and they haven't stood up, and the Republicans have been rubber stamping. And I say, where are the principled Republicans? Because traditional Republicans stand for balanced budgets, constitutional government, non-interventionist foreign policy, keeping the government out of our personal lives and states' rights. And this administration violates every single one of those. Yeah. Gutting the Constitution with the Patriot Act, the Fourth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, even the First Amendment now is under assault. Running up $9 trillion in deficits, in launching these wars that are, you know, the wars, these are preventative wars, which means you're launching them because you think that another nation might threaten your interests at some stage in the future. That's exactly the same rationale that Emperor Hirohito offered in justifying his attack on Pearl Harbor. So if 9/11, if 7 December 1941 is a day that will live in infamy, then I dare say that our attack, the day we attacked Iraq, is also going to live in infamy. Not to mention our personal lives, you know, not just the surveillance, but, you know, getting into everything that Americans want to do as far as, you know, choosing even the size of their families. This has become a huge issue with this administration. And then interfering in states' rights, you know, with the Terry Schiavo case in Florida and death with dignity in Oregon, I mean, all these other things. I don't understand, where are the principled Republicans? These are not Republicans. They're some kind of neo-fascist operation here. It's shocking.
They could be scared, too. I mean, there was anthrax released on Congress. And there's been biological scares. Maybe they're just being, you know, blackmailed.
And that anthrax was released on the two key Democrats who actually were wanting to take a critical look at the Patriot Act right at the time they were wanting to take that critical look. So it looks as though that was very nicely targeted. It was high-quality anthrax. It clearly was military grade.
Absolutely.
There are only a couple places in the world where it could have been manufactured. One of them is Fort Detrick in Maryland, so I suspect that's exactly where it came from. But somehow our vast investigative services were unable to track it down. Isn't that amazing?
Well, Judicial Watch wanted to know why the White House began taking Cipro on 911 about a month before the anthrax attacks, which is prima facie evidence that they knew.
Oh, that's pretty fascinating. You know, I was unaware of that when it slipped by me. That's fascinating.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have a feeling that Tom Fitton and the people at Judicial Watch are under gag order. the process server. They were subpoenaed in the White House to find out where they got their medicine from and why they began taking it.
That's extremely interesting.
The process server was turned away, which is illegal.
That's extremely interesting and extremely telling. We have joined with Judicial Watch in calling for the release of 12 different categories of evidence in relation to 9/11. And if anyone out there would like to support us in requesting that this evidence be released, you can visit our website at st911.org and find the petition in the top left corner of our webpage. And we would be so grateful if you would join us. It's a petition that's being sent to every member of Congress and every member of the House and every member of the Senate that they should support the release of all of this kinds of evidence. Just reading through the petition is a learning experience in relation to how much the government has been concealing and keeping this information from the American public.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'm glad to see that you have Judicial Watch on your side. They've argued some cases. In one, before the Supreme Court, they lost the Cheney duck hunting case to get a look at that Cheney secret energy meeting.
Let's take a step further. I mean, clearly these people deserve to be impeached, but they will never be impeached as long as we have one-party government. So we need to reconstitute the Congress. Mm-hmm. If the House or the Senate return to Democratic hands, you're going to see a earthquake proportion change in what's going on in Washington if we ever get to the election. But I think they have been having a lot of success in the past using these electronic voting machines to steal elections, as far back as 2000 in Florida, where they were suppressing the black vote and using these machines to steal elections. And then 2002 in Georgia, Max Cleland had a 17-point lead going into Election Day, and yet miraculously he lost. And all these voting machines were turning up the same number, 18181, which had to have something to do with their registers or the way they'd been, manipulated. And then, of course, in 2004, in both Ohio and Florida, it was outrageous. I mean, the owners of these companies are Republicans, and they make no bones about wanting to deliver their states to Bush, and they go about doing it. And then you have guys like this Blackwell, the Secretary of State in Ohio, who was blatant about manipulating the vote for the sake of the Bush people. So it's truly disgusting. You cannot abide electronic voting machines in your state if you want to have honest elections. You need to go back to paper ballots, party supervision, ordinary counts. It's cheaper, it's more reliable, and it's overwhelmingly more honest. I mean, they are stealing democracy beneath our very nose, and they're using our money to do it. Interestingly, that's a Bush family policy, other people's money. They call it OPM. They use other people's money to make their own money. It's been the family policy forever.
Well, I'm in Ohio, so I got to witness this voter fraud firsthand. And we knew it was, we suspected it was going to happen before it happened because the CEO of Diebold, Wally O'Dell, expressed his desires to bring the presidency to George W. Bush. And then we have Blackwell. Noe was stealing money from the, with the help of Taft, stealing money from the Workers' Compensation Fund and doling it out to Republican campaign coffers. He's been indicted. It's just incredible. Blackwell commits voter fraud. He wouldn't let the public watch the vote be counted.
The extent of the corruption is truly overwhelming. I mean, on the assassinationscience.com, I have five, six, or seven major studies about the way in which these electronic voting machines were used to steal elections. Now you have the Secretary of State out in California who impaneled a group of experts to evaluate the Diebold machines. They came back with a devastating report talking about all the ways the machines could be hacked and manipulated. Mm-hmm. And in the dead of night, at midnight before a holiday, he went ahead and certified them. Now that's about as outrageous as it can get. I mean, this is the kind of person who's, a traitor to democracy. I mean, this whole Bush administration, all the key players, are betraying the principles that this country is supposed to stand for. They're violating. Bush took an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. He has betrayed that oath. He obviously would be subject to impeachment if there were any justice in the world. In fact, these people are traitors to the United States.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Feingold, he tried to make a move in that direction, and he's the one that ended up getting chastised. Jeez.
That's well, these guys really are very not. Clever. They're very clever. They're very punitive. They're very relentless. You know, take
the
case.
Think they're clever.
Yeah,
I just think
they are clever, but they're corrupt. I mean, yeah. it's really terrible. That's the thing that differentiates good men from bad men. Bad men are willing to do things that good men aren't willing to do, which is one reason why good men can be preyed upon by bad men. I mean, when you had, Joe Wilson, this former ambassador, go to Niger and discover that the documents that were supposed to justify the conclusion that Saddam had been trying to obtain yellow cake to produce nuclear weapons had been forged, they didn't congratulate him or thank him for doing a good job, for being honest and getting to the bottom of matters. Instead, they outed his wife, Valerie Plame, who was a covert agent working for the CIA and responsible for maintaining a network that was seeking to contain the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Now, if there is any more important operation in the entire apparatus of American intelligence, I have no idea what it would be, because this has to be as important as it gets. And yet they outed her just out of vindiction, being nasty, punitive, retaliatory. This is unworthy of an American government, and it places us all in jeopardy. I mean, this man has done more to weaken the security of the United States than I could have imagined possible, and this is just one striking illustration. Running up massive deficits, so we have $9 trillion in deficit now, means the country is basically bankrupt. And insofar as national security is rooted in financial security, economic security, he has gutted it. The many generals and officials with the National Guard have observed that the Army is virtually broken and the National Guard is on the verge of collapse because of these ongoing military operations. So he's actually also greatly weakened, if not shattered, our military strength. And, of course, on top of it, he has completely vilified the country, and we have lost our moral standing in the eyes of the world, so we're no longer admired and respected. We may be feared, but we no longer have that admiration we used to enjoy.
Yeah, it's just amazing. It really is just amazing. You know, I don't know if you followed the London bombings, but it was similar to 9/11 in that they were running drills at the time for bombs being set off in the subways.
You're absolutely right. You know, the stunning thing about that is the drills were just the very stations where those bombings were taking place.
That's crazy, isn't it?
It is. I was there in London not long thereafter, and even went through one of those stations. And, just thinking about it, it's just so blatant. It's so obvious. I mean, it's like Cheney running these so-called terrorist training operations from the basement of the White House. I mean, it's just in your face as it could be.
And Benjamin Netanyahu was forewarned.
And Netanyahu, when asked about the effect of 9/11, said it would be good for Israel. Obviously, it was good for Israel. He would claim that it meant that now the United States knows what it feels like to be attacked. But what he was really talking about was an aggressive American posture in the Middle East. So, I mean, the Israelis, of course, had a legitimate beef with Saddam because he was putting up $25,000 bounties for the families of suicide bombers. But the fact is that the United States didn't have any legitimate beef with Saddam Hussein, except in the mind of George W. Bush, who apparently came into office thinking that the great presidents are the war presidents, so he wanted to have a war so he would show he'd be a great president. Well, he's such a mediocrity, and his understanding of history and politics is so shallow that, he's a guy who would precipitate a war because he thought it was going to make him look good. And look how it was done. I mean, this whole thing had to involve all kinds of orchestration on the part of the American government in order to occur. And now, I mean, of course, 9/11.
Yeah, I'm not sure what we're going to do to stop this. I don't know if Bush is stupid. He overthrew the U.S. government for all intents and purposes and appointed himself dictator. He's got secret police now. Did you see his signing addendum to the Patriot Act?
Well, yeah, what he does is impose his interpretation now on laws. You know, it's very funny. I go back to all the way when he was debating with Al Gore. And I don't know if I was the only one who noticed, but when he talked about the functions of the government, he said the function of the legislature was to pass laws, and the function of the executive was to interpret them. He never even mentioned the judiciary, so he didn't even have a high school student's level of understanding of the American government. Now, I thought Al Gore should have just clobbered him, but Al was preoccupied with something else, didn't even notice. Now he's actually implementing that policy by imposing an executive branch interpretation on the laws. which means that the executive now is, even if they aren't actually passing the law, they are passing their interpretation of the law by imposing it upon us, which is utterly unconstitutional and simply guts the whole process of checks and balances between the three branches of government.
And then in the meantime, packs the Supreme Court so that even if you did get some action before the Supreme Court, it'd be highly likely that the Alitos, the Scalias, and the rest of that bunch would probably vote in favor of Bush's power.
Well, it's fairly scary, you know, this idea, this doctrine of the unitary presidency, where, he's supposed to be all-powerful and transcend the Constitution, is so un-American, anti-democratic, authoritarian. I mean, we're talking about a veritable form of totalitarianism beginning to take shape here in the country. I mean, this is the very sort of thing we're supposed to be fighting against. How can we bring in freedom and democracy to other countries if we don't have freedom and democracy at the world, at home? I mean, it's ludicrous.
Smoke and mirrors.
Smoke and mirrors.
They're tremendous liars. I mean, they'd lie even when they don't need to sometimes, I think.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Let me just say, my greatest fear, of course, is that, they're not going to want to relinquish power. They know they're all guilty of all kinds of serious crimes. They don't want to be prosecuted. They don't want to be tried. They don't want to go to jail. And I think that it's all too likely that before the next election, they're going to manipulate, orchestrate another fake terrorist attack, suspend the Constitution, and declare some kind of national security military police state. This is what I foresee. We have heard a lot of reports about detention camps being set up all over the country, and Halliburton was recently given something like $390 million to refurbish or pursue additional construction. To me, it's very scary. I mean, you know, who's going to go in those concentration camps? I think they're conducting surveillance now on everybody because you can't know who's Al-Qaeda if you don't actually listen to everybody and then do data mining. So they're just lying. You know, they cut off those inquiries immediately because they knew it was so threatening. As soon as the American people realize that all of us are under surveillance for our phone conversations and email all the time. They're trying to figure out who they want to put in those camps. I mean, it's absolutely horrifying. It really is a reflection of parallels to Nazi Germany, and I'm just extremely apprehensive that the American military may be too docile and compliant not to realize that they actually have an obligation not to respond to illegal orders. I mean, my fear is that the American government may try to use the American military against the American people, and we've seen several signs where they're trying to dump Posse Comitatus Act that makes it illegal to use American military to perform police functions in Katrina, for example, where I believe that it was deliberate to withhold forms of assistance for New Orleans until it got so terrible that when he sent in the 82nd Airborne, of all things, it would look like the cavalry was arriving. I mean, what's the 82nd Airborne doing in New Orleans? They're trained to kill. What's the Louisiana National Guard doing in Iraq? Those guys are trained for natural disasters. This has to be deliberate. These people are very smart. And then when they talk about bird flu epidemics and creating quarantines using the military, well, the bird flu hasn't even evolved to a point where it's actually contagious human to human. So there's no real prospect at present of there being an epidemic, and yet they're talking about using the military because they're trying to condition the American people to abandon Posse Comitatus. I say this is extremely serious. I therefore now align myself with the NRA on the Second Amendment. I say every family in America ought to arm itself, get automatic weapons, get armor-piercing bullets, get anti-tank weapons if you want, because we may have to become citizen soldiers again and fight a second revolutionary war if my reading of this administration is correct.
Well, like someone once said, in these days, if you're not paranoid, you're just not paying attention.
Yeah. And as a friend of mine said, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't out to get you.
Do you know about this statement that the Project for the New American Century made in their document? They published it, put it out on the Internet. Here's what they said. Advanced forms of biological warfare that can target specific genotypes may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool.
Isn't that scary? Doesn't that just scare the wits out of you? So what are they going to do? They're going to find, genotypic effective bioweapons, and they're going to annihilate what, all blacks, or are they going to annihilate all Orientals, or are they going to annihilate, you know, who are they going to annihilate? They're going to annihilate everyone except themselves. I mean, it's another version of the kind of racism that dominated the, you know, the Aryan Brotherhood concept for Nazi Germany. It's a parallel. These neocons are very scary people. They're totally un-American. They betray every value for which this nation stands. They're willing to subvert the Constitution. They place the president above the rule of law. This is a frightening time in American history. I think if we survive it, historians will look back upon it as the enormous long black chapter in American history.
If we write history, if they write history, it'll be a great time, probably.
We
have to write history.
We got to survive it first.
Yep, we've got to survive it first, because this is what concerns me with their capabilities in genetic engineering. They can take a bird flu and make it into something that will do some damage. Then they have all kinds of pretexts to lock down cities. You know, oh, you can't go there, you'll spread the bird flu. Yeah, that's the
concept. Oh, I think you're on the right track. You know, there's a lot of speculation that AIDS actually originated as a military experiment, and that it got out of control, or maybe it didn't, because, you know, I mean, this is homosexuals are not a popular group, and they AIDS is a disease that predominantly affects homosexuals. So, I mean, it could have been something that was intended to target that group.
Black Africans are quite affected.
And black Africans, too. It's all very scary. This is terrible stuff. I mean, maybe that's a prototype of this biological, genotype engineering weapon that you're talking about that the neocons are endorsing. I mean, this is frightening.
Sorry.
And it's in your face.
It really is. Now, they did respond. I made a page about that, about their, because I read their crazy document, Rebuilding America's Military for the New Century. And they actually responded to that and denied that they were genocidal. Because I never said they were genocidal. They denied being genocidal.
Oh, that's very interesting, isn't it?
That statement certainly sounds genocidal to me, and they were defending themselves because it got out on the Internet. They said, oops, we better do some damage control here. Yeah, they deny their genocidal intent.
Well, that's very interesting, yes. Sometimes you protest too much.
Yeah. Well, some of the things they said, like a new Pearl Harbor.
Yep.
They need a new Pearl Harbor?
Oh, I know. That's exactly where you find the blueprint for what's actually happened. So I encourage everyone out there to go online, do a Google search, go for Project for the New American Century, check out their document about evaluating or rebuilding America's defenses, and it's going to curl your hair, send a chill down your spine. And when you read about how they want to create a dominant American empire greater than the Roman Empire, they want to project American forces in the Middle East, but they don't think the American people are going to go along with it because they're so used to democracy and don't want to make the financial and personal sacrifices of the blood of their sons and daughters, and that it's unlikely to come to pass, save for a precipitating, traumatizing incident such as a new Pearl Harbor. Just realize this is the incipient plan for 9/11 right there. You're reading it right there from the authors right there.
Well, you can also look at other documents like Zbigniew Brzezinski's book.
Yes.
What was that called?
The Grand Chessboard. 1997, Zbig sketching out exactly the same scheme. And, of course, he was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. I've always thought Zbig was a pretty good guy, but when I read his book there, it sent a chill up my spine, because he uses exactly the same phrase. He talks about the same general game plan, and he talks about the need for a new Pearl Harbor.
Now, I don't think the foreign policy, which I believe is developed by trilaterals and Council for Foreign Relations and those guys, changes from president to president. And if a president were to try to change that policy or that plan, they'd probably end up like Kennedy.
Well, that, you know, I think there's a consensus that that was Jack's problem. He actually thought he was president of the United States.
Well, with the Federal Reserve, too. He went up against the feds. He turned down Operation Northwoods and Mongoose to create pretext for the invasion of Cuba. And I think all those things is what did him in.
Yeah, he was using Westmoreland to vet all those proposals coming from the chief and shooting them down. He was going to cut the oil depletion allowance, which upset the Texas oilmen. He was, of course, for the reasons I already sketched, he had opposed an invasion of Cuba against the unanimous recommendation of the chiefs. He'd signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union against their unanimous opposition, and he'd gone ahead and was pulling forces out of Vietnam, where they thought a stand had to be taken against communism. The mob was upset against with Jack. They wanted to regain the resorts and casinos in Havana, where they were running the biggest money laundering operation in the Western Hemisphere. They also wanted to get Bobby off their backs, and there's some belief that they felt Jack had betrayed them. Joe may have entered into some kind of agreement with the mob about the election, so if it were close, that Giancana would make sure Chicago went for Jack in a big way in Illinois. And, of course, it was close, and Chicago did go, and so did Illinois, and Jack, of course, won. But I don't think Bobby or Jack would have ever had anything to do with the mob, but their dad, I wouldn't put it past him. Mm. And, of course, the chiefs, not only were the chiefs upset, the CIA was fearful that Jack was going to shatter it into 1,000 pieces, which he'd promised to do in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs, where he discovered they'd massively misled him. Lyndon wanted to become president of all the people. Hoover wanted to stay on as the director of the FBI. You had an unholy alliance between all of these forces that came together to take him out.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Sharon? Do you think... he says that he doesn't remember doing it at all. Even under hypnosis, he has no memory of it.
Yeah, well, Sirhan had a high suggestibility quotient. He's just a perfect kind of subject for suggestibility under hypnosis, and you could make it a condition of that you would have a blank slate thereafter. He appears to have been a patsy in a similar way to Lee Oswald, who was actually on the second floor drinking a Coke when the whole thing went down. More shots were fired than came from Sirhan's revolver. He never got close enough. Bobby was shot from an inch and a half behind his right ear. Sirhan never got closer than about a yard and a half. I mean, it's ridiculous. There was a security guard behind Bobby who probably was the person responsible for shooting him, a guy named Caesar, who had the same caliber weapon as Sirhan.
Mm-hmm.
But the LAPD seemed to wipe the whole thing up. I mean, they had a famous medical examiner named Noguchi, I think, who actually came up with conclusions that the contrary to the police department, and the medical examiner got fired when they should have reinvestigated the police department because they clearly were covering things up. That was a nasty case. I think it was a loose end after Jack's death, and Bobby let it be known he would reopen the investigation of his brother if he became president, and there were those who thought that would not be a good idea.
So, Jim, we're running out of time here, and I don't know, what in the heck can we do? What would be the next or the first best thing to do to try to stem this this slide down the slippery slope into the abyss?
Well, you got to do two or three things. You got to get rid of these voting machines. I've been heartened that a number of states are conducting experiments and discovering that they're completely unreliable. You got to get rid of them. We need to have a serious election if we can get there. We need to keep pressure. We need to get the American people aware that 9/11 was a complete hoax, that the American government was using violence and threats of violence to instill fear into the American people in order to manipulate us for the sake of their own political agenda, which, of course, if you check it, is the definition of terrorism, so that the American government has been practicing terrorism on the American people. Mm-hmm. We have to get rid of these people. And if they won't go kindly, we have to make sure that our American forces know they should not follow illegal orders. If they try to turn the American military on the American people, we're going to face a catastrophe that may lead to the necessity to fight a second American revolution. That is what I fear. That's what I think they're going to try to do.
That may be the case. I do that every time I run into a GI. Military people has explained to them that they should not violate the solemn oath that they took to defend the Constitution.
That's right. The Nuremberg trials made the point that because you're following orders is no defense. If those orders are illegal, they should not be followed, but actively opposed. And I don't think it requires rocket science. The problem is, that if we had a volunteer force, I'd feel much more comfortable, but we've got this professionalized army now, and they have hired so many private military outfits like Blackwater to perform actions that it's very scary now that you got a gang of, you may have a group of professional killers that are going to obey those superiors regardless of what orders are given. I only hope that there's enough integrity in those American hearts and souls that they're not going to use their weapons against the American people, because I think it may come down to that.
Unfortunately, I think I have to agree with you there. This is crunch time, and we've got a heck of a mountain to climb. Some of us are actually getting out there and doing things. Myself, I've been, for the last 4 years or so, doing this radio show and the website and telling everybody I know, in an effort to expose what happened on 9-1-1. I've been called everything but Hitler. I have been called Hitler himself.
Well, I'll tell you, if everyone will just let others know that they've, say, run into this stuff on this website, ST-911, it really bothers them. The more they learn about 9-11, the more troubled they are that this whole thing has been a charade, a hoax, manipulation of the American people. If they sign on to our petition to gain release of all these documents and records and physical evidence and films and so forth, that can bring additional pressure on the administration. It's going to be a long, hard fight, but we have to join together for the sake of the nation.
We certainly do. Yeah, I agree with you entirely on that one, for sure. It's been really interesting talking with you, Jim. You've got so much information, and we didn't even get to the tip of the iceberg as far as the whole picture. But what we should do, I suppose, is expose 911 as a good place to start the vote machines, and keeping pressure on the representatives.
I think that's right, because 9-11 has been used to manipulate everything. I mean, that has been his sole source of support, which has been wildly dropping. And everyone should understand that while Charlie Sheen spoke out and was attacked for saying so, he wasn't saying anything that experts and students of the case haven't been saying for 5 years. So now we have an organization of experts and scholars that can substantiate everything that Charlie Sheen was saying, because we've established it on the basis of our own independent, objective, and scientific research.
How many scholars or PhDs do you have in your numbers at this
My
point?
Guess is going to be we probably have around 100. Mm-hmm. There are 225. We got about in four different categories. We have those with academic affiliations or the equivalent. That's the largest group. And then we have a group of those are the full members. Then we have a group of associate members that have background and training suitable to investigating different aspects. So there are many different levels of academic training. And then there is a group of student members. And then finally, society affiliates, which is our smallest category, which are just members of the public that want to express support for the organization. So we have quite a substantial number distributed across quite a range of disciplines, including physics and mechanical engineering and pilots and aeronautical engineers. And we have undertaken research on such a wide range of aspects of the case, including establishing that these guys could not have piloted the plane and that the cell phone calls could not have taken place, in addition to, of course, the discovery that David Ray Griffin begins by talking about in his book about the 9/11 Commission report, namely that four or five or six of these guys have turned up alive and well and living in Saudi Arabia, and yet the FBI has not seen fit to revise its list. Their names don't even appear on any passenger manifest, nor are any of them subject to any autopsy reports, which gives you some idea of the extent to which the administration has gone to fake this whole thing.
That's just amazing. Well, we've got 2 minutes left. I don't know how we should spend them. Yeah, that phone thing was Project Achilles. I think it was a gentleman named A.K. Downey.
Dwadney. Yeah. Listen, he's quite a brilliant guy. He's got a proposal, an analysis of the way the whole thing went down. By the way, if people are interested, let me give you A.K. Dwadney's analysis called Operation Pearl. Here's what he thinks actually happened on 9/11. Four commercial passenger jets took off, and shortly after the pilots were ordered to land, those were 11, 77, 93, and 175. These planes, by the way, were only about one quarter full, which is very odd for flying transcontinental. Two previously prepared planes, a Boeing 767 made to look like a United Airlines jet, which was probably a military version of a 767, a fuel tanker with more fuel aboard, take off and are flown by remote control to intercept the paths of American Airlines 11 and UA-175. They then fly toward Manhattan. One crashes into the north and the other the south tower. A fighter jet under remote control crashes into the Pentagon. Back at the airport where these passengers have all been offloaded, they're put into the 4th United Airlines 93. The plane takes off, flies toward Washington, but is shot down over Pennsylvania by a U.S. Air Force jet, eliminating all the innocent witnesses. And then under cloak of darkness, the other planes are disposed of, probably in the Atlantic. That's a thumbnail sketch of a very plausible scenario that it can account for most of what has taken place in relation to our evidence about 9/11.
One thing I disagree with there is I believe that Flight 93 landed at Cleveland Hopkins Airport.
Well, it did. It did. It did land. I've seen that report, too, about 93 landing at Hopkins Airport. But the fact, you know, very strange thing going on here in Pennsylvania. I had residents calling me to tell me that they told the FBI they heard an explosion in the sky. The FBI wouldn't write it down. Others wrote to tell me that sheriffs had taken them to an area outside the official designated crash site and looking for body parts and airplane debris and said that if they told anyone, they would deny it. I have an inspector general, former inspector general for the Air Force, who used to investigate crashes, telling me that if it had crashed the way the government claims, the debris would have been spread over one city block when, in fact, it spread over 8 square miles. I've got another colonel who also was involved in investigating air crashes who told me that the crash site looked to him as though they'd taken a bulldozer out, dug a trench, put trash in it, and blown it up. So I'm telling you, we got a hell of a lot of evidence that whatever happened there, it wasn't what the government said. There are also reports that a Major Rick Gibney, who was with a hotshot Air National Guard unit called the Happy Hooligans that was transferred temporarily from Fargo, North Dakota to Langley, actually was scrambled. And there's a report online under, I think, letsroll.org that gives an exact timeline of when they were activated, scrambled, and when the Major shot him down and how he received medals and awards for doing so. I'm inclined to think that's true, even though today the Major denies that it happened.
Yeah, there could have been more than one Flight 93, too. I mean, they could have shot down any commercial aircraft that they
all had. Kinds of things, but I gather there were a whole lot of body parts found out there, like, you know, like some 12,000 body parts. Really quite a mess, okay? This is really catastrophic, what the government has done here.
See, I didn't know that they found any body parts at all.
I believe so. I was reading about it.
There's so much information and disinformation, it's hard to sort it all out.
That's absolutely true. So, you know, I'm willing to say let's keep piecing it together because it's characteristic of scientific research that as you get more evidence, you may revise some of your conclusions.
Sure.
And discover that some findings may be mistaken. That one, I would hate to think that I had confounded it because I might be talking about total number of body parts from from all sources of incident on 9/11.
See,
so I'll take another look at that.
I haven't seen any clear indications of autopsies and DNA identification. For example, there's a Dr. Olmsted that sued for the freedom of under the Freedom of Information Act for the autopsies of the people on Flight 77, the one that hit the Pentagon, and found that there were no Arabs listed in the autopsies.
Yes.
So you wonder, well, why not?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, they don't appear on any flight manifest. They don't appear on any autopsy list, and five or six or seven have turned up alive and well living in Saudi Arabia, even confirmed by the Saudi Arabian embassy, and yet the FBI has not revised their list. So it's really quite shocking. It's quite blatant. I mean, the power of the government, you know, they think they can just ignore these things, and there we are. What can we do about it? Well, what we can do is try to reveal the truth to the American people.
And that's what we're doing right here. You know, and we have to market this idea, not using the media, but in spite of the media. I mean, we can't get on NBC and talk about this stuff. We should be able to, in my opinion.
Well, freedom of speech freedom of speech and freedom of the press are in a bad way in the United States today, I'm sorry to say. And I want to compliment you for doing your show. I think it's extremely important. I'm afraid that the Internet and talk shows are the last bastion of freedom of speech in America, and they're going to try to clamp down on both. I have absolutely no doubt. That's another sure sign of fascism encroaching.
Yep, I've got an email that hasn't been opened yet where the headline is, "The elites are planning on taking over the Internet."
I know. Very scary. Very scary. I mean, we couldn't possibly be doing what we're doing without the Internet.
No,
so I say, you know, I hope everyone out there will visit st911.org and study all the evidence that we have accumulated there. There's quite a lot of it. It includes audio and video recordings, scientific studies, documents, records, whatever. It's all put together there on st911.
Yep, st911. Been there, looked at all the stuff there, plenty to look at. And if you're not convinced after you've looked at all that, then you're probably never going to be convinced.
Well, I want to thank you for having me on. This has been a real pleasure.
Yeah, I've had a lot of fun with it. I'm glad we finally got